From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More U.S. arms for Israel? U.S. President Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met at the White House Monday for the first time in more than a year for talks that reportedly covered a wide range of issues, including the war in Syria, the Iran nuclear agreement, and Israeli-Palestinian violence. The discussions between Netanyahu and Obama also reportedly included a new 10-year U.S. arms deal for Tel Aviv. CCTV's Jessica Stone filed this report from the White House.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived in Washington as a fresh wave of Middle East violence broke out between Israelis and Palestinians.
There's going to be a lot of work to do.
Inside the White House Monday, discussions with U.S. President Barack Obama went forward on a new 10-year deal for the U.S. to arm Israel. Israel has already ordered 50 American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, and it's expected to ask Washington to increase its $3 billion in annual aid. Netanyahu hopes to get $50 billion over 10 years, starting in 2017 when the current arrangement of U.S. military assistance expires.
The military assistance that we provide, we consider not only an important part of our obligation to the security of the state of Israel, but also an important part of U.S. Security infrastructure in the region.
I don't think that anyone should doubt Israel's determination to defend itself against terror and destruction.
Even as Israel worked to negotiate a new defense agreement in October, its defense minister blamed Iran for this fall's unrest.
In general, I will say that Iran makes non-stop attempts at harming Israel and its citizens.
Netanyahu and Obama have been bitterly divided over the world power's denuclearization agreement with Iran, yet both agree a peace agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians is unlikely during Obama's presidency. Netanyahu says he hasn't given up hope.
I remain committed to a vision of peace, of two states for two peoples, a demilitarized Palestinian state that recognizes the Jewish state.
Both leaders agree on one thing, at least, and that is that they do not expect the prospect of a peace agreement to be reached during the course of the Obama administration. Netanyahu, though, says he still believes that peace is possible. But that said, he has not slowed the pace of West Bank settlements. In fact, a new one just got approved. Jessica Stone, CCTV at the White House.
There was also some trouble evident both inside and outside the White House meeting. RT's Alexei Yaroshevsky reported after the meeting's end on the friction that was evident between the two leaders.
Now, the meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu and President Obama has concluded in Washington, D.C., and maybe a good indicator that these talks were not easy ones was the fact that the conversation lasted for 45 minutes longer than it was originally scheduled. Definitely, relations have been frosty, especially in the last 12 months or so, and one of the missions of Netanyahu here in Washington, D.C. is, of course, to defrost those relationships, but another one, a more important one, is to ask for more money from the United States. Now, we know that Israel has been receiving around $3 billion worth of military aid every year from the United States. Some analysts are suggesting that Netanyahu is here to ask for $5 billion a year. In fact, this is stipulated in a memorandum of understanding between the two countries, which is expiring in 2017. And before that deal expires, Netanyahu wants more funding in the times what he describes as very sort of violent and volatile in the region, particularly between Palestine and Israel. So far, it seems that both leaders have been trying to keep the meeting rather calm and quiet. We do know that there will be several protests held in Washington, D.C. We are, of course, monitoring the situation there. We'll be bringing the details as we get the information.
And outside the White House, the first of those protests was being held. This was Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition, one of the protest organizers.
What a disgrace that Netanyahu is here being wined and dined at the White House, right, when the place he should be is in The Hague in the International Criminal Court for having committed crimes against humanity.
Right.
Netanyahu does not deserve immunity from war crimes, right, or crimes against humanity.
Meanwhile, the vulnerability and isolation of Palestinian refugees is approaching a level that has not been seen for generations, That, according to the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, which reports that there are 5.2 million Palestinian refugees living in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, and surrounding countries. Matthew Wells has more.
The UNRWA Commissioner General, Pierre Krahenbuhl, updated the General Assembly on the agency's work by saying that the challenges facing refugees have rarely been greater. He said a funding crisis which threatened to keep schools for Palestinian children permanently closed last year had been narrowly averted, but now there were bigger challenges being faced this year by all Palestinian refugees.
Their vulnerability and isolation is being intensified, reaching levels not seen in generations, as conflicts expand in the Middle East region and thrust one community after another into extreme insecurity. The present situation has created a new existential crisis.
He said that extra funding from UN member states to meet a major budget shortfall was still urgently needed, and the disruption to the agency's school system in conflict areas of Syria and elsewhere continued to be profound. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said that participants in the upcoming talks on Syria need to reach an agreement on exactly which groups involved in the conflict should be designated as terrorists.
There are two important items on the agenda for the next meeting of Vienna. First is determining which groups are terrorists, which is clear to us, and then agreeing on how to proceed from there.
Zarif made the remarks during a press conference with a visiting Belgian foreign minister in Tehran. He said fighting against terrorism is an international obligation. Zarif noted that Syria's future must be decided by its own people and that the crisis requires a political solution. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov warned that the next round of talks on Syria must not focus on demands for President Bashar al-Assad's resignation. Speaking with reporters on a trip to Armenia, Lavrov said the attempt to reduce the talks to Assad's fate was a simplistic approach that would only blunt efforts to find a solution to the crisis. Echoing the Iranian foreign minister, Lavrov said agreement on a list separating terrorists from legitimate Syrian opposition is a necessary precondition to a solution. The top Russian diplomat called for wider participation in future talks on Syria, including the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Arab League. A week after the UN hosted a symposium whose stated purpose was to end government impunity against journalists, it appears that some governments may have taken note, while others may not. In Egypt, the military released journalist Hassan Baygat Tuesday, hours before planned demonstrations were set to take place in Cairo, London, and elsewhere, calling for his freedom. Baygat is the founder of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights. He publishes his articles in English and Arabic for the online news organization Mada Masr. The Egyptian military had summoned him Sunday for interrogation about a recent report he published describing criminal convictions against 26 military officers for plotting a coup. He had been detained since then and was under investigation by a military prosecutor on charges of publishing false news harmful to national security, a crime that, under Egyptian law, is punishable with jail. It was not immediately clear whether Baygat could still face those charges after his release. Meanwhile, Turkey was blasted by the European Union Tuesday for failing to respect human rights and press freedom, calling on Ankara to urgently address the problem. In its annual report on Turkey's prospects for EU membership, the 28-nation bloc said that, under Turkey's current president, there has been, quote, serious backsliding, closed quote, on basic human rights, including freedom of the press, speech, and assembly. A summary of the report condemned what it described as a, quote, overall negative trend in the respect for the rule of law and fundamental rights, closed quote. The EU is not the only European organization to note the hostile environment for journalists in Turkey. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, reported that the number of journalists in prison in the country exceeds 20, almost three times the number reported by the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists. Many of these, according to the OSCE, face or have been convicted of charges under anti-terrorism laws. The number of detentions, judicial prosecutions, censorship cases, and layoffs has soared as authorities maintained strong pressure on the media. This applied not only to journalists, but also to writers and users of social media. A conference on the Black radical tradition has been scheduled for January 8th through 10th at Philadelphia's Temple University. Dr. Anthony Montero, who was until recently a professor of African American studies at Temple, is one of the conference organizers. Dr. Montero told Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford that it's time for the Black liberation movement to get focused.
You know, we're in the throes of an emerging and intensifying movement that is proliferating. The most visible part of the movement is the anti-police state violence, but it includes the struggle for schools, the struggle for jobs, the struggles against gentrification. So we have this proliferating set of movements without yet a clear vision or ideology. And what we hope to do at the conference on the Black radical tradition is to help to develop a vision of the future and an ideology about what the fight is and where to target, ultimately to target the fight.
Well, what is the Black radical tradition? And I don't think that's a naive question, in that I doubt that many people could define the Black radical tradition or even recognize that there is one.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. And that's part of what we intend to do at the conference, to define just what this tradition is. In many ways, it begins in the anti-slavery struggle, probably with Black abolitionism, Henry Highland Garnett, Mariah Stewart, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, and it continues in the post-slavery struggle, especially with those men and women who were fighting for democracy and for Black Reconstruction between 1865 and maybe 1880. Some of them were elected to the Congress and to the Senate and to state houses. Others were responsible for establishing public schools. And then by the 1890s, we have, I think, the crystallization of what we could call the modern Black radical tradition, with people like Anna Julia Cooper, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Alexander Crummell, and of course, probably the most important figure in this whole tradition, W.E.B. Du Bois. And as we move into the 20th century, the Black radical tradition becomes part of the socialist movement, but also of the anti-war, anti-World War I movement, the anti-colonial movements, and after the Russian Revolution, the Black radical tradition gravitates towards solidarity with the Russian Revolution. Many of the outstanding figures of the Black radical tradition of that time become communist and Marxist. And this only intensifies with the Great Depression. And then we get post-World War II and McCarthyism and the attempt to crush the Black radical tradition, both in its theorizing and its activism. But then it emerges again with the Civil Rights Movement. And as we follow the trajectory of the Civil Rights Movement, both in people like Martin Luther King Jr., but also in people like Mamie Till Mobley, the mother of Emmett Till, who takes this profound stance against the murder of her son and stands as a figure, in my mind, in the Black radical tradition from the standpoint of her militant stance against the lynching of her son in Mississippi. And her stance was so outstanding that it inspired Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott movement of the 1950s. But then, of course, Malcolm X emerges, Martin Luther King evolves into a figure that opposes capitalism and war and racism. Malcolm X is this exemplary figure in revolutionary black nationalism. And then it continues with the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton, and so on. And, of course, up till today, where we see this movement emerging that, if it continues, has nowhere to go except to take up the trajectory that was begun by earlier movements, which means in effect, opposition to capitalism, white supremacy, and U.S. empire.
When we speak of the people and the movements that you just mentioned, who are part of the Black radical tradition, we should also talk about those historically who have not been part of that tradition, who've been part of what might have been called the Black accommodationist tradition of Booker T. Washington and such, and that tradition also continues to this day.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it continues in the form of what you all at Black Agenda Report have defined as the Black misleadership class. And this group, which emerges after the Civil Rights Movement, kind of crystallized as a bourgeois class strata of the Black community, who become a buffer between the masses of working and poor Black people and the white ruling elite. And in fact, not just a buffer, but apologist for them. And at the same time, are constituted as a parasitic growth upon the Black community. They do not engage in any kind of productive work, but benefit mightily from their administrative, almost neo-colonial role in relationship to Black people. But in a way, they go back to Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington, however, was never as bad as most of these are.
So there's nothing strange, nothing ahistorical about Black folks arguing with each other and splitting into different camps politically. Those who consider themselves heirs to the Black radical tradition and others.
You're right. There's always been this attempt on the part of both reactionary cultural nationalists and petty bourgeois reformists and apologists to say that we're all Black people. Why should we divide ourselves along class and ideological lines? And then when they say that, they're pointing the finger at those who are critical of their politics and of their ideology. But the response must be that it is not the critics of the accommodationist positions, be they from the standpoint of reactionary nationalism or petty bourgeois reformism. We did not create the class division. We did not create the politics of accommodation. We only pursue a principled politics of going to the people in order to encourage and to foment militant resistance. What the apologists seek to do is to weaken any efforts at militant resistance to white supremacy and the economic crisis that is thrust upon ordinary Black folk.
The apologists within the Black community seem to have the upper hand nowadays. We don't hear much about imperialism and class in the Black political conversation these days.
Yeah, they do have an upper hand, and they will always have a relative upper hand because of their connections to the centers of white power in the country. The apologists can only continue to be prominent and really to exist, not because they are autonomous and dependent upon the Black community for their existence, but because they are dependent upon the centers of white capitalist power. And for that reason, they behave as middlemen and as apologists for the very system that is oppressing the majority of their own people. But in times like this, new possibilities open up. And what we see, especially among young people, and especially among that vanguard of activists, a urge towards something different, to a higher level of struggle. And those are the people that we're trying to address in this conference.
As you observe the new crop of activists, is it your assessment that there is a conscious effort on their part to follow in the Black radical tradition, to measure their works by that of icons such as Dr. King and Malcolm X and Du Bois and others?
There's no doubt in my mind that that exists. Clearly, the commercial media wants to diminish the significance of that among the young generation. But I believe that that is the majority tendency. You know, what I see is the emergence of political and ideological tendencies among this generation, not unlike the tendencies that produce the Black Panther Party, that produce the stage of Martin Luther King's evolution, of his uniting war, racism, and economic exploitation as triple evils. I see the same thing among this generation of youth. And I also see that element that is very similar to the young people who went into the South in the 1960s, you know, young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the Congress of Racial Equality, who went down South on freedom rides, on lunch counter sit-ins, on voting registration drives, and put their bodies on the line. This element is not the element that you see creating hashtags. This is a whole different element. These are not connected to foundations and other external agencies of funding for the Black community. This group, unlike the young SNCC and CORE activists, are really anti-capitalist. And they are not interested in a discussion about change that does not include a change in the economic system, as well as a change that totally brings down the system of white supremacy.
And yet the tendency, the current towards accommodation is evident today.
Oh, no question about it. It's very evident. But in my interaction with students and non-student young people, they have very little, if any, respect for the accommodationist in their generation. Most of them are really not fooled by them and are seeking a different path, a path not of being apologists or even celebrities that are to be found on CNN or MSNBC or are upheld by the editorial pages of the New York Times or the Democratic Party National Committee. I mean, the real driving forces, be they in Ferguson or Baltimore or Philadelphia or Oakland or Chicago, of this movement want nothing to do with the establishment, or they don't seek legitimation from the establishment.
Is this multi-generational range of activism going to be reflected in the conference at Temple in January?
Oh, most definitely so. I mean, it's going to be, I think, something very historic. There will be that generation of Angela Davis, of Cornel West, of Robin Kelly, but then there'll be that generation of academics like Stephen Salata and Vijay Prashad, but there also be people like Alicia Garza and Charlene Carruthers. But then there'll be people whose names we don't actually know. The students from Students for Justice in Palestine, students from the various Black Students Union around Philadelphia, at Temple, and from universities up and down the East Coast, but also youth coming out of the churches and out of the labor unions and out of the streets, the unemployed, the impoverished youth. So I think we're going to get that cross-section, and it will be multi-generational, but it will be focused upon a vision of a future that is different from what we are living now.
Every epoch has its own particular contradictions and conditions, and from that come demands. What do you think the demands that you'll see being articulated at this conference might be?
I think they're really going to be radical demands. I think we're not just going to talk about minor reforms in policing. I think people are going to talk about community control and the undermining or destruction of the structures and institutions of police power in the Black community today. I think people are going to talk about something wholly different. I think we will be addressing the issue of American empire and war and enduring or unending wars and dangerous wars with provocations against China and Russia. I think this question of U.S. empire and military bases is going to be addressed. But certainly the questions of joblessness and the destruction of public education. In fact, the first day of the conference will start with a march entitled A March for Our Future that'll be led by a coalition of young people and students, high school and college students, and young people who are unemployed, who will march on the Philadelphia School Board and protest against the closing down of public education and replacing it with charter schools. We will have, on the second day of the conference, a march against gentrification. And we will target, in particular, Temple University and this plan to build a football stadium, a $100 million, 40,000-seat football stadium in the middle of Black North Philadelphia, which will change the character of North Philadelphia from a community to I don't know what. So this will not only be a conference about activism, but will be a conference that will include activism. And it will, in this whole context, attempt to come up with a radical consensus that will inform a vision of the future and will thereby suggest strategies and tactics on local levels of fighting for this future.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from the Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.